Mackenzie,
What up, Lamar?
our girl Riley, she's growing up so
She
fast.
is. She
She
is.
really is.
Fast.
She's, growing into this young woman, and obviously a lot of changes going on inside of her. And I wanted to ask you, do you have a moment specifically that stands out to you, sort of a defining moment from puberty, preteen, teenage, those formative years?
I don't know if it's like one moment. I do think that there were these very like multiple really formative experiences in middle school. So not quite like Riley, where she's, I think she's going into high school, but like more in middle school where you are kind of entering puberty, which is something they allude to here in the movie. But I was in a school with a lot of mean girls, and I think that middle school is rampant with that, you know what I mean, in
I think
general.
every school's got their mean girl. As a middle school teacher, I'm pretty sure every school's got their mean girls and their mean boys, but mean girls
Right.
more
Like, I
often.
just think middle school is the time where like girls are the worst. And it's because, and I, we'll get into this later. It's because we're all going through the same shit that Riley goes through in this movie, and everybody's, trying to adjust to their new reality. But I think what was really hard for me was being Hispanic in that school and being made fun of for things that I literally couldn't control, like the hair on my arms being dark, and being called disparaging names for Hispanic girls, and having pranks played on me by people who just thought it would be funny, like inviting me to something that I wasn't invited to. And what it taught me, though, I mean this sincerely, is obviously it was hurtful at the time. It was really sad and painful. But I was kind of a social butterfly. I had a lot of friends in a lot of different groups. And what I realized was that these groups of mean girls that I was also trying to be friends with were just not worth my time, like, and I came to realize that really quickly. And I'm glad that I did, instead of continually trying to be friends with them. It was like a marked shift for me in the mental state of everybody just is nice and wants to be friends. Like, I really came there with that mentality of let's all just be friends with each other. I was very idealistic. And then I kind of learned over that period, like, not everybody's going to be friends. Not everybody's going to get along. And these people are just kind of shitty and not worth your time. And so I think I spent sixth grade being kind of miserable. And then after that, I was like super content. I
That's
didn't give a
you
shit.
realized all that at a very young age, because I feel like it's almost instinctive. I think humans, it's kind of like there's this anytime you go to change lanes on the highway and the person that's in that speeds up, it's just this human. I don't know why we do the stupid things that we do, but we're like, no, you're not getting in front of it. Even though it has barely any bearing. I mean, there's a difference. I'm not saying when you cut somebody off, but I'm saying you throw on your signal and the person 100 feet behind you is like,
Just
nope.
gets possessive of the lane all of a sudden.
It's that sort of instinct that I see in people, not just middle schoolers, but people in general. Like, we're very exclusionary. We like to feel as though we're part of the in crowd, and you
Because it makes you
can,
feel better. You're better,
it's like, oh, we're gonna make fun. You can people watch this at bars or wherever
Right.
you're out and about, of whoever the largest group is in the bar, it thinks that they're the coolest ones there, and they're like talking shit. I'm not saying it happens 100% of the time, but it's just this really weird thing that
It's a
humans
very
do.
human experience. And I don't think I would have been able to, like you said, I realized it quickly. I think the only reason I realized that quickly is because I had other people. You know what I mean? I had other friends that I could relate to and connect with, and who welcomed me with open arms and vice versa, and treated me the way friends are supposed to treat you. And as long as you have that outlet, I think it's that direct comparison that helps you come out of it, right? But there are so many people that don't get to have that experience, and it takes longer to get there all on your own. I was lucky to have friends who helped me got through it, so, get through it. So,
I think that, like, as somebody who's 5'4", like, I think I learned from an early age in middle school, high school, you can be the person that's getting bullied, or you can join the peep. And it sucks that that's the way that life is. But this is coming for somebody who's been a dick at different times in their life. I've been that person who's like, well, I better kind of be funny and be able to mock other people, or else people will make fun of me. It's this insecurity that was instilled from that super young age.
It's a lot of growth to get through that, and Riley learns the same here as well. So what about you? Like, what's a big, formative moment in your high school or puberty kind of experience?
I mean, you just gave sort of a super emotional. I appreciate you sharing all of that. So I guess I would say that mine is probably the first time I touched boobs. I think that's top of the list, day number one. you know, core memory for sure. It's ingrained in there. I like to reflect on it every so often.
That's your emotional moment of your childhood. Yes. I like it. Yep. Yep. I get it. I can see it. I can see it.
Let's start the show.
Welcome back to We Drink and We Watch Things. I'm Mackenzie.
I'm Lamar.
And we are continuing our month of summer blockbusters with what maybe feels a little out of left field. It did for me, at least, but is a hit. Inside Out 2.
It felt like sort of the oddball out from our choices, but it ended up being literally the biggest,
the best performing, yeah.
animated film of all time. So I don't think you get much more blockbuster than that.
No, definitely not. And I think I looked it up last night too when I was just googling some stuff, and they're still showing. So like it's got success to go. But we'll get into all that. But before we do, what are we drinking?
We are drinking a concoction, as always, provided by Craft World. So make sure to give them a follow. This one here is 2 ounces of bourbon, an ounce of sweet and sour, an ounce of Grand Marnier, half ounce of simple syrup or agave, whatever you got on hand, and a little bit of cherry juice. And we're calling this, wait for it, Anxiety, T-E-A. Get it? The character in the movie.
I did that, guys. I'm really proud of it. Okay, but no spoilers, but there's a reference in the movie for this that makes sense. So you will get it later. Also, bartender's note, agave is a little better here, and the sweet and sour should be fresh.
I made that mistake because I I did not use fresh sweet and sour. I should have just made it myself. And I see what Craft World was going for here. It does taste kind of like a sweet tea, but I made this shit way too sweet.
Yeah.
So I'm still going to drink it because it was my own screw up. But make sure you stick to the recipe out there, guys.
It is a play on a Long Island iced tea, but it is a little bit, little bit changed. So anyway.
That's what it, okay. This plus Coca-Cola is a Long Island iced tea. I was trying to place the taste, and that is accurate.
Yeah, but those of us who don't drink soda had to riff on that a little. So here we are. Anyway, cheers.
Cheers.
Alrighty, well, here we go. Inside Out 2, which, as we know, is a 2024 film. These are this summer's blockbusters. We've got some solid ratings out of this one. Like we said, this has been very successful as a film. And I would say notably as a sequel, right? Like,
yeah.
Of the ones that do well, the Disneys and the Pixars, you know, they probably have stronger sequel showings. But this is kind of bananas to me, I feel like. 7.8 out of 10 on IMDb. Almost an 8 out of 10. 91% critics on Rotten Tomatoes and 95% audience.
I'd also be curious to go back and look at how it stacks up next to the first one. Considering that it's 9 years between the releases, the story, I think, is only a 2-year gap of Riley from the first one to when she's going to high school in this. So that's kind of a difficult jump to make, especially with like an animated feature where some of the voice cast, we'll get into that, doesn't come back. But I feel like maybe they proved everything wrong with just breaking the mold of, you can release an animated sequel 9 years after the original and still make it original and fun and make a shit ton of money.
Yeah. So the original was an 8.1 out of 10 on IMDb.
Slightly higher.
Yeah. And I think the other thing I want to note here for you guys giving things a goog, there is a radically different Inside Out film. Just... not PG.
Is it a porn?
Yep. Not a
okay. don't Google Inside Out.
So don't Google Inside Out. And really, frankly, don't IMDb Inside Out, because it always brings up the other one first. And I had this shocking experience multiple times.
Was it? Okay. So we know it's a porn. Is it a porn parody of Inside Out where they just didn't change the name
it's
at all? They were like, that works. We're just going to make a porn
all of
called
it.
That.
No, okay. It's like a 90s porn, and it's actually a bunch of like vignettes. So it's like all these like short porn stories. It's so,
that,
I mean,
it
of
sounds
course,
great.
I'm
going to watch it this weekend.
I mean, they can't serve it up to me and expect me not to look into it. So I definitely looked into it. Anyway.
You watched it all for research purposes.
It was pure research. yeah. So anyway, Inside Out obviously did really well, and it held up over the first one, is I think the thing that, that points out. That's a pretty solid sequel rating, I think.
Yeah, I will say before we even get into our scores, I liked the moral of the story in this, and I thought it was a little more creative than the first. I still think I prefer the first one. Like, the first one's a better film, but I thought this did it a lot of justice.
I think it, much like the first one, it just makes sense. You know what I mean? It, like, the way they have built this universe makes so much sense, and they continue to build it out in a way that is so relatable, and again, continues to make so much sense. And it's like such a reasonable explanation. You're like, this all checks out. That, like, this is what's going on in my brain. Totally fine.
Relatable was the exact word I had in my head.
But yeah, I agree. I think this one is maybe not quite as strong as the first one, but it's still very strong. So anyway, we'll get into all that in just a minute. We're going to knock out some basics pretty quick. The director, Kelsey Mann, is a first-time director for this one. Longtime Pixar contributor. She's been a writer for a few things, done some shorts, but this looks to be her first directing debut, and pretty solid outing, it seems
and
like.
wasn't involved in the first film, which is kind of the running theme of some of the folks in this. We'll get into that in a second, but I think they did bring back, I'm sure you're gonna get into the writers, they brought back one of the writers from the first Inside Out. What was her name?
Meg LaFauve.
So Meg is back, thank goodness, because I was going to say, for it being a change in some of the folks involved in this, it does feel pretty seamless for a first-time director who wasn't involved in the first film. It doesn't feel like one of those straight-to-video sequels from the 90s, you know?
Yeah. That was a very different time in animated sequels, for sure.
When you could just exploit children of, like, we're going to make a sequel to this film your kids love, but none of the voice cast is back.
None of it's the same. Don't watch Beauty and the Beast 2, guys. It's not the same. It's not the same. Totally. And then Dave Holstein is another writer, helped with the screenplay, did some pretty different stuff than this, like was a TV writer for a lot of different things, including Weeds. Yeah. 68 Whiskey, Kidding, a bunch of like a little bit heavier material. Definitely some other lighter material peppered in there, but I just thought that was funny to note that he writes very different things.
I think the three of these folks, I didn't see. Did you see The Good Dinosaur? 2015?
I did, and I 8 out of 10 do not recommend.
Ooh.
I warn everyone I can that it is not as sweet and wholesome and gooey and beautiful as it purports to be in the trailer, and you will just leave that movie heartbroken, and I hate it. So
rather than The Good Dinosaur, what would you change the word good to in that title?
The Saddest Dinosaur.
The Saddest Dinosaur. Okay. At least we have a more accurate view.
Very sad. I can't watch it ever again. Anyway.
But so I guess the three of these folks met there. That was the first thing they collaborated on. And then they were like, hey, we're making a sequel to Inside Out. You guys want on board? And the three of them trio came in and killed it here.
And the director was like, let's fucking lighten it up. Okay. Over The Good Dinosaur. Let's lighten it up. Yeah. So major cast and crew. Speaking of people who have come back or not come back, let's get into that. So obviously Amy Poehler comes back as Joy, which is, you know, again, like a core cast member, would totally be noticeable if she didn't. Mm-hmm. Also, we've talked about her at length on the pod, but quick refresher.
Wet Hot American Summer.
Wet Hot American Summer, she's in Sisters, Parks and Rec, a bunch of great stuff. Obviously, she's fucking hilarious.
Deuce Bigelow, Male Gigolo. Don't remember. I haven't seen that movie in 25 years. She's apparently in that. So
I know. I don't remember where she would be in that. But yeah, same thing. I haven't seen it in ages.
I guess Rob was off SNL by that point, but maybe because she was on SNL around then, they were like, you know, that part.
They seem to like to cameo in each other's stuff. Right. So it could be very small for sure. So yeah, so we have that. We also have Kensington Tallman, who's playing Riley, who hasn't done a lot else besides these two, right? Like, she's done a lot of other kiddo type of movies, like
mostly,
you know,
like TV series.
TV series, kiddo type of Disney series kind of movies. Like, that seems to be her thing, which is
Her last name is Tallman. So I'm wondering, her great 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 grandfather came over to Ellis Island and they were like, what's your last name? And they were like, Inspiakadopoulos. And they went, you're pretty tall. Your new name is Tallman.
It's probably very much that kind of story. They were like, how do we make this easier on us? This is about us, right?
We're Americans. We're Americans.
We also have Lisa Lapira, who is a replacement. So as you all may remember, Disgust was played by the one, the only Mindy Kaling, who is quite hilarious and I think did a great job on that, but did not get paid enough to come back. So she was replaced with this woman who's actually pretty funny. I've seen her in a couple other things. Crazy Stupid Love, she was a super funny character in. She was also in Fast and Furious, which feels very different. And then a lot of TV kind of stuff. But yeah, that was a controversial replacement, along with Bill Hader, who also did not come back.
And I'm fine with the Tony Hale replacement, because I love Tony Hale ever since he was on Arrested Development and Very Veep. Funny. He was also in this sort of obscure indie film maybe 5 or 6 years ago called Brave New Jersey. And it was fine. It wasn't mind blowing for an indie film. I was like, fuck yeah, I gotta go. I was fist pumping all 90 minutes. But in it, it's, I think it takes place during the War of the Worlds broadcast, where this town in New Jersey thinks there is an alien invasion, and it's them reacting to the War of the Worlds. It was pretty clever. Like, it was a cool concept. It wasn't mind-blowing, but it was worth seeing.
That's cute. Yeah, he's good. I think he's funny. Like you said, Arrested Development, Veep. And another one that I have to point out that I think is super fun is that he was in Toy Story 4 as what I feel is a really critical character, Forky. If you remember that movie, very important character, integral to the film, and very funny.
I only
funny.
Remember, I don't think that film, I thought they should have ended Toy Story at 3, honestly, but the only memorable parts of 4 were Forky and then Keanu Reeves as the motorcycle guy. That's the only things I remember about Toy Story 4.
I am not a big, like, Toy Story fan. I had to come back to that bandwagon later, and I would still say it's not my favorite Pixar, but I did like Forky. I thought Forky was funny. I just loved the concept of you can make a toy out of anything and enjoy it. And anyway, he was also in Hocus Pocus 2 as the mayor, much to the chagrin of many people who didn't like that that reboot.
Interesting.
But yeah, they didn't get, neither Bill Hader or Mindy Kaling got paid enough dinero, which I did the math on this actually. So they were each offered $100,000 to come back, and then a percentage of the royalties of the first $858.8 million of this film. They would get 0.01% if they had participated.
That's at least $20, at least.
At least $20. But
they could go see the movie and get a small soda.
It seemed like their complaint was more about, like, Amy Poehler, for example, got $5 million plus bonuses, right? They were going to be offered $100,000 plus bonuses. It's not clear what her bonuses were, so who knows. But what this would have paid them out, based on how well this film has performed, is $8.85 million.
Like I said, at least $20. So at least $20.
Yeah. So I'm like, I think you guys, like, made the wrong move here, like made the wrong bet here. I don't know if they just thought the sequel wouldn't do well or what.
I would assume that it was probably the disparity between Poehler and the rest of the cast. I get Amy Poehler is, you know, the main star of the first one, but
yeah,
$5 million for her versus $100,000 for everyone else. That to me, like, as a sports person, I was like, you hear about Tom Brady when he was playing, taking less money in his contract so they could get better players on the team. And there's some players who were like, fuck you, pay me, give me the max contract. And that's kind of what I don't know Amy Poehler, but I
was
going
to say,
like,
who knows? I attribute that to their agents and things. So, but I hear, I would feel awkward, but I don't know. I guess, like, I'm too cheap. And I guess money motivated, because I would be like, that's a solid paycheck. Like, I will take it. It's voice work. You know what I mean?
Just,
like,
for the record, you're in for Inside Out 3. If the offer comes through, you're down.
The offer comes through.
You're not SAG certified yet, but we can get you there.
I can get there quick. Let's do it. Okay. Moving on. Sorry, y'all. I just thought that was crazy. Lewis Black is back as Anger. We've talked about him before as well. He's mostly known for his stand-up, but he's been in a couple of films, including Man of the Year, obviously Inside Out, the first one, and then a few other, like, a ton of other, I should say, TV appearances. I feel like he's a shtick on a lot of existing TV shows.
He has a distinct voice. Yeah, he's one of the, we talk about, you know, distinct voices like H. John Benjamin in Hot American Summer and Bob's Burgers and everything he does. I was shocked when I looked at Lewis Black's filmography to see that he's been acting since the 80s, and it wasn't until the late aughts that he went, oh, you know what? My voice is pretty distinct. Let me start doing cartoons. Very strange.
But I think he's perfect. I mean, honestly, of all the cartoon work, like, this is the best one. This is his personality, and I think it's hilarious. So it works out great. He was the perfect man for this. And then, of course, our last OG, Phyllis Smith, comes back as Sadness. She also, fun fact, came out of retirement to do this, which is hilarious. And she would not come to LA to do this. She refused to record outside of Missouri, which is where she lives, which I thought
she was getting too old for this shit, I guess.
Yeah. too old to go to LA. She's like, I'm not here for this LA nonsense. Look, and woman after my own heart. I love
it. And for the record, we talked about, you know, the two people who did get unfortunately replaced in this cast. I don't think it's super noticeable in those two cases. Like, yes, it's a different voice, but it still plays. I feel like Phyllis as Sadness, that would have been one you noticed.
That would have been a hard one. Yeah, that would have been a hard one to replace, I think. She's a very, also a very distinct voice, I agree. Mm-hmm. And I feel like it's just kind of much like in The Office. Like, it's just part of her personality, you know? It just fits. So we also have some new characters that Lamar is going to take us through quickly so we don't super spoil it. But some of this is in the trailer, so calm it, they.
Yeah, so if you don't want zero spoilers about who the new emotions are, you can stop listening here and go watch the movie. It's very good, and it's still in theaters, apparently. But I wanted to call out that we have Maya Hawke as Anxiety, is probably the one that everyone recognizes, yeah. Daughter of Uma Thurman and Ethan Hawke. And she's paid some dues. She's been acting since 2015 or so. You probably all recognize her from Stranger Things, but she's done a lot of other stuff. I think she's also a musician, too, right?
Yeah, and she did Asteroid City. Recently, a Wes Anderson.
Okay.
And she did Maestro. And she also did Do Revenge, which I haven't seen, but looks really good, actually. Looks funny. Yeah.
She's also in one of the Fear Street movies, which I think are underrated. They came out and didn't really get much play because they were sort of Netflix exclusives. But the Fear Street series, if you like schlocky horror slasher films, they're worth watching. But we have Ayo Edebiri as Envy, and you all know her from The Bear and the new TMNT Mutant Mayhem. She has another distinct voice where as soon as you hear it, you're like, oh, that's Ayo. She's awesome. Mm-hmm. I know I'm going to butcher this name, so apologies in advance. I'll get the first name right. Adele, I assume. Her last name, Exarchopoulos. I really, Adele, if you're hearing this, if you're one of our listeners, sincere apologies if I messed that up. But she plays Anhui, who's one of my favorite of the newcomers. Not a ton of dialogue, but every piece of dialogue is super valuable.
Chef's kiss. It's great. It's great.
We have Paul Walter Hauser as Embarrassment. Talk about no dialogue. Very, very little lines but lots of nervous noises and ticks that he does. And then finally, we have June Squibb as Nostalgia, kills the scenes that she's in. I recognize her from Palm Springs, which we were just talking about before recording. Probably my really favorite movie of 2020, because not a lot of movies came out in 2020, so it was kind of slim pickings, but worth watching, absolutely.
Feels kind of COVID-y as a movie. I'll just leave that there, but
in a good way, in a meta kind of way. The last two things I wanted to call out as far as cast goes is the parents of Riley, who again don't get a ton of action here, but didn't know that was Diane Lane and Kyle MacLachlan.
That's interesting.
Choice there, and they obviously do well in the scenes they're in. And then Diane Lane gives me
strong mom vibes. Like, I just, in the best way, like, seems like she'd be such a sweet, wholesome mom. So I don't know.
Diane Lane, it gives me the opposite because she was in the movie Unfaithful with Richard Gere. That's right. That's my Diane Lane and my core memories. So
solid reference too. That's a distinctly different Diane Lane for sure.
Yeah. And then the last one that I want to call out, we talked about Parks and Rec. We've talked about The Office. Let's talk about another NBC sitcom, and that's Community. And Yvette Nicole Brown, I didn't realize watching it, but she plays the hockey coach in this. And I love her so much. And I think she's underrated because on Community, they had her playing this character who appears 10 years older than Yvette is. And then after she got off the show, I was like, oh, she's, and not to say she's not attractive on the show, but they downplay how gorgeous this woman is. So kudos to her for like getting where she's at now. Yeah. Yeah. They have her playing a mother of two, and like, she just, they age her up. It just seems very, so her fashion is very, you know, suburban religious mother. And then you see her in real life and you're like, oh, wow. Okay. So good on her.
Sidebar, and we can cut this, but I just had this experience with a movie. I think it's Just Go With It. It was like a preview of it, and it's like one of those Adam Sandler and Jennifer Aniston ones. And they
damn, that Adam Sandler, what a looker.
Hard fucking no. Anyway, I was like, they tried to make Jennifer Aniston into a frumpy wife at the beginning. Like, there's this whole makeup experience with her. Like, she gets this big makeover and all of a sudden she's gorgeous. It's like, bitch, you can't make Jennifer Aniston not look gorgeous. Like, shut up. What is this storyline? Anyway.
I feel like movies that try to do that shit should just cast a different actress for the before part.
Right.
Just cast someone else. Looks really and then close, they get a makeover and it's like, oh shit, it was Jennifer Aniston the whole time. Wow.
That would resonate better for sure. So anyway, we did not blow through that, by the way. So I'm going to blow through this plot summary and our spoiler-free rating before we get going. So, quick plot summary if you haven't seen the trailer or you haven't seen it yet. A sequel that features Riley entering puberty and experiencing brand new, more complex emotions as a result. As Riley tries to adapt to her teenage years, her old emotions try to adapt to the possibility of being replaced.
Dun, dun, dun.
Yeesh. That's hardcore. Man, shit's about to go down. which it really does. It really does. So before we get into what all went down, what's your spoiler-free rating?
Spoiler-free rating. I thought this was really enjoyable. Didn't love it as much as the first, but thought it ran with the concept. It kind of expanded, I guess I'll use the term lore here. It expands the lore of the universe. Mm-hmm. It does feel a bit like a rehash of, okay, we're doing this again, but I thought it did it justice. Like, I would recommend it to anybody who liked the first for sure. I'd give it, yeah, like an 8. I thought it was really enjoyable, not perfect by any means. And there's a couple, you know, downsides to it. It does get a little slow at points, but absolutely worth watching and enjoyable.
Totally agree. Plus one to all of that. I gave it a 7.5. But yeah, like, I think it's, it does a really good job, like I said at the top, of just making it all feel relatable and make sense. And I just continue to love that about this universe. I think there were some opportunity areas, and we'll get into those. Yeah. But I do think on the whole, it did really well. And it resonates with how strong it's going at the box office, which is at currently sitting at almost $1.6 billion with a B. Against a $200 million budget, which is, for context, guys, outperforming Deadpool, outperforming Twisters, outperforming everything else that's been at the box office, and most certainly, like you said earlier, highest performing animated film, period.
It's almost like if you market something, a product, a service to children, you're going to make a lot of money. I don't understand the science of it, but why didn't Deadpool and Wolverine pull in this much money?
They need to get their shit together. That's why.
Just market Deadpool to 8-year-olds, please.
Because they're going to bug their parents until they go, right? Like, that's what it is. It's that the parents are just trying to shut the kids up. They're like, fine, we'll go.
And then they want to see it again and again and again.
100%.
Coming from a guy who watched The Little Mermaid probably 16 times as a child because my sister wanted to watch it all the time. So
that was me. I think we've talked about this on the pod. Yeah. That was me with The Little Mermaid. I was like, this is the most perfect film ever made. Why would we not watch it 100 times?
I know that they have the Nickelodeon Kids' Choice Awards, but they should really consider letting kids vote for the Oscars one year. Just let children decide. Just mix it up a little bit. I would watch. I would watch the all 6 hours of that.
Yes, the nominations should come from kids, I think, is the distinctly different thing there, because the Oscars are quite dark on the whole, as you all have heard me talk about in the past. So yeah, let's let the kids take over one year. We can all experience some joy, you know? It would be nice.
Well, Joy would be nominated, so very fitting that, yeah.
Joy would obviously be nominated, yes. 100%.
The kids wouldn't even know who plays her. Just like, nominate Joy as best actress. Okay.
100%. Okay, so as we said, this is all about Riley hitting puberty. It's a couple years after the first one, and this is obviously a traumatic period, I think, in almost everyone's lives. Even if it's not the body stuff, it's all the other stuff, right? But the combo of the two is fucking terrible. So she, like, literally overnight, this happens to her. She's going into high school. We learn that she has this new element that has come to the center of this story, almost, where we got the same core four, like we said before, and they're all contributing to Riley's current sense of self along with her memories. And that sense of self is the core of Riley, right? Mm-hmm. What we learn about this is that Joy, bless her, love her, is still on her shit from before and is like, you know what? Negative memories? Fuck that. She's like, let's get him out of here. Just
there's no way this will come back to haunt us.
She's just like, and what we love about Joy is that she has learned that sadness is critical to this equation and that it's okay to feel these emotions. So we are very proud of Joy's growth here, but I think this is still a little reminiscent.
It's a bad strategy.
Right. It's a bad strategy. This is reminiscent of Joy 1.0, who's still like, but you know what? We don't need that many bad memories, you know? So she just shoots him to the back of the mind, which I think, again, so relatable. Like, who doesn't do that as a person? You're like, you know what? I just don't want to think about that. Let's just pretend like that never happened.
Dude, think about the things in your life where you did something really stupid or hurtful at the age of 14 and you still think about it to this day.
Oh, 100%.
Mackenzie, 100%. You're what, 22? Like, yeah. This stuff.
Obviously.
Like, I'm going to be 40 next week and I still think about stupid shit that I said or did
100%.
From that time. And you have those memories back there. I think this film does a great job of, again, expanding on the concept of the first one of we're inside someone's brain, but the way that they represent all these different things is pretty spot on. You use the word relatable, and that's, yeah, 110%.
Yeah, I think it's, a very human experience of, like, I don't want to relive all the most terrible things that I've ever done in my life, you know, but, or I've been around for, or I've embarrassed myself or whatever, and all these things. So what we've come to find out is, like, the plot forward movement here is that she has her two best friends. They all play hockey like she did in the first one. They want to get on the Firehawks high school team. And we learn that she's the only one who's going to be at that high school, though. So, like, mm-hmm. this is a big deal for her because her two best friends are going to go to a different school. They're playing at this event, practice, it seems, or something like that, maybe camp. They get invited to a skills camp to maybe get on the Firehawks early, which is exciting. But she finds out on the way to this that her best friends won't be going to this high school. This camp has so much pressure on it. Like, you could potentially make the team as coming out of the skills camp. It's a big deal to go to this camp. And of course, the puberty alarm gets hit the night before camp. And I just thought this was the funniest fucking scene.
Where they break everything down and like everything. Rebuild the construction crew. Yeah, yeah.
I think it's such a cute scene where, like, they're all in their bunks, they're all asleep. Joy has the little stars, you know, that mm-hmm. Riley also has and had been imagining in the first film. And, you know, they all are, like, their little bunks are reflective of their little personalities. And they all get woken up in the middle of the night by this horrific alarm and this construction crew of mind workers who come in and they just fucking wreck the original console. They're like, you know what? This is an upgrade. Meanwhile, it's like, you know, practically duct taped together. There's all these new functions. And they leave it a mess, that was my favorite part, is that they leave this whole upper area console mind in disarray. The whole thing is that now that puberty has shown up, shit is wrecked, you know? And so,
and then they take, like, they have to, they don't know how to operate Riley at this point, mm-hmm. our core set of characters. They're hitting the wrong buttons and stuff. And eventually, Anxiety and the other new cast join to sort of show how this new operating system works. And I wanted to call out that, again, my middle school teaching experience of these new characters are, again, spot on. The kid with the hoodie, like, closed as tight. Yep. That is a person I've seen. I've seen 100%. Children do that.
We all saw that.
The anxiety-ridden kid who's like, I got a 99. I need 100. Like, otherwise, I'm not perfect. I've seen those students. You got your hand up, Mackenzie. Yes.
Yep.
Even the envy, like, all these ennui, just the kids that want to be on their phones.
Oh, my God. The ennui of it all.
That is so spot on.
So fucking funny. So funny. It is just, like you said, they don't know how to operate it because this console is hypersensitive now. Like, she flies off the handle whichever way anytime you lightly touch it. And I love the cutaway to her mom where she pops off at her mom, which, like, teenage daughters everywhere unite, we all did this. And her mom has this moment of, like, well, there's a preview of the next 10 years. Like, she's like, buckle in, you know, it's about to go down.
I wanted to point out, I didn't know where to discuss this, but we had mentioned, we jokingly said, oh, make Deadpool and Wolverine for kids. Do you think that this movie in any way, not with the child audience, obviously, but with the adult audience, did you feel that this was impacted in any way by the fact that in the last 9 years since the first one came out, the TV show Big Mouth has debuted and sort of done something very similar to this? Because even the fight with the mom, I'm thinking of, I think that's episode 2 of Big Mouth. She hits puberty and immediately goes off on her mother, and her hormone monster is like, that's not mom anymore, that's Shannon. Like, that, those kind of things. Do you think this movie is impacted for the adult audience, or does it not really matter, you think?
Well, one, that sounds relatable, but two, I have nothing to contribute having never seen Big Mouth.
Okay, well, Big Mouth is basically Inside Out 2 for our rating, so it's the opposite of the Deadpool Wolverine conversation we had.
Right, but to your point about adult, is this pivoted to adults at all? Yes, I absolutely think it is, because I think it's like, it's one of those things that, you know, you can know and appreciate better in retrospect, right? Like, yeah. I would be interested to talk more to teenagers or even younger kids, you know, 8, 10, like my nephews and nieces, and ask them, like, like, was this funny? What did you like about it? You know, like kind of see like what resonated with them, because I think a lot of times it's just not going to hit the same way because we have all this perspective. We have all this context that they don't have. So I think it kills two birds with one stone. And that's why it can be so high performing at the box office. Cause yeah. I mean, I went and saw it by myself, not with a kid, right? I'm like, this is still hilarious. This is still a great movie because it speaks to me.
Yeah. I wonder, when you're talking about speaking to your nieces and nephews and whatnot, would they feel personally attacked by these things, or would they be like, no, that's not me? Like, you know, everyone remembers how you were when you were 12.
Nephew, like, my teenage nephew would probably like be like, that's not me. You know, he's mm-hmm. at that age of like, I'm too unique. Cool for
them. I'm the only one who's like me.
I'm know? Different. But like, you can see these things show up in them. And I hope he never hears this, but like, you can see where his anxieties are starting to show up. You can see where he's starting to feel embarrassed about things he wouldn't have before. And it's, I think maybe as an older, you know, presence in a kid's life, it's one of the hardest things to see. Like, I can't even imagine how it feels for parents. I love my nephews and niece more than anything on this planet. And it's so hard and a little bit heartbreaking to watch that invade. It really yeah. is. And like, these emotions start to come in and you just think that they're just perfection and they're joyous and they're beautiful and they're fun and creative and all these wonderful things about these kids, because they are. And then, you know, the world kind of gets to them and these things start to, you know, basically break through in a terrible way. And they do, they make you into really good, well-rounded people over the long term. But I think in the short term, it's hard to watch them feel all these emotions at a really turbulent time.
And you are speaking from experiencing, like, you're empathizing of, yeah. I went through that. I totally understand where you're coming, but it's when you're in that moment, nothing anyone on the outside tells you,
you
is going to solve
that. You cannot permeate the membrane. Yeah. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, I just think of myself at that time too. And I was like, you know, not that every single thing that my parents ever said was right, but you're like, I get this now. I get this thing now. I understand mm-hmm. this part now. And you want to just protect them from it and help them understand and see themselves better and feel more confident. I think that's the thing I wish I could impart to all of those kiddos and to every kid, but especially, you know, my sister's kiddos, of like, you get to be exactly who you are and it's a gem. You're a gem. Okay. And you don't have to mold yourself around embarrassment or judgment or these other things. Like, the things that you love are valid. The things about you that you're passionate about are valid. And like, that's hard to get through because this whole movie is about self-doubt. It's about this self-doubt creeping in, you know? Yeah.
It's interesting that you say all that. I wasn't even going to mention this. I'd seen a theory online that said in the first movie, obviously, at the end, we get to see the brains of other characters and which emotions are controlling them. And in yeah. this, we get a little bit of that near the end, I believe, where we see the inside of Riley's parents' minds. And it's mm-hmm. still the same characters as the first one. I think anxiety might be present in both of their brains still, but mm-hmm. embarrassment, ennui, all those emotions aren't present in their brains. So some people yeah. theorize that's the message of the film is, hey, these are puberty hormone, teenage emotions. Yeah. And eventually when you become more comfortable with yourself, this stuff's going to go away. I don't know right. if I agree 110%, but I think that might be what the movie's trying to say.
I think it's trying to say that these four core are going to always be here, mm-hmm. right? And these other things, including other ones that we don't get a close look at, like you said, like nostalgia.
When did you start getting your nostalgia inside brain?
I mean, I think it can. I think it comes in at the weirdest times, actually, because mm-hmm. even when you're like 15, you can be nostalgic for something that happened when you were 8, right? You can be, when you were 30, you can be nostalgic for something that happened when you were 20, right? I think that's one of those emotions that comes and goes, you know?
For me, it wasn't until I saw or heard Paul Rudd in Knocked Up say, I wish I loved anything as much as my kids love bubbles. I think that was when nostalgia got thrown into my brain. And then you start reflecting on, oh, the good times we had in college and high school and blah, blah, blah. But
it's so true. It's one of the things that Amy Poehler said about this movie. She was like, coming back to do this work feels like such healing work. I feel like you get this connection to your younger self. And you start to feel nostalgic for the time of simpler emotions, of just sadness and fear, just mm-hmm. joy and, you know, these things. And so I think it's something that, yeah, the overall film is telling you this is the most tumultuous time because all the fucking emotions are coming in and out and they're all poorly managed, right? They're just not able to balance themselves. And there are people who deal with that in the long term. Like, I wouldn't say I am an anxious person on the whole, but I definitely deal with anxiety. It comes and goes, mm-hmm. right? And I think most people would identify with that. You're like, oh my God, this is what this felt like. This is the moment I started to feel self-conscious. You know, I used to be so brave and so confident, and these things came in and made me feel self-conscious.
Yeah, the we're going to say the word relatable probably 100 more times by the end of this podcast. But that feeling of anxiety of worrying about what every single person around you thinks, God, that's yeah. something we all can relate to. And even my friend Bailey, who I got her all clear to share this, so thank you, Bailey. She encouraged mm-hmm. me to see this film in theaters. I was going to wait for it to be streaming. But she said that depiction of panic attacks that takes place in this mm-hmm. film is mm-hmm. so accurate to what she experiences, that it really, that was yeah. the most emotional point of the movie, was holy shit, other people experience this. And this feeling that's going on inside of you of you're not good enough, you're not smart enough, you're not talented enough, what if I fuck up, all these things are things that a lot of us can relate to. I'm lucky enough to have never experienced panic attacks, but that momentary, just all that weighing on you's got to be rough. Mm-hmm.
And I can identify with Bailey. I've had a couple. I mean, again, I don't think I have anxiety disorder per se, but I've had a couple panic attacks. And that is, I agree, totally how they feel. And I think this segues nicely into like a core moment in the film that shifts for Riley, which is that her sense of self by anxiety, because of anxiety, gets launched away mm-hmm. in order to fit in, right? Her sense of self at the beginning is I'm a good person. You know, and it gets launched into the ether back with those other memories so that she can fit in, because that is the most critical thing. Because anxiety is extrapolating out every possible ending to the story, right? Mm-hmm. And that is absolutely what anxiety feels like. If I have to prepare for every single eventuality and I have to think every single one of them through, and obviously 98% of them are terrible, and I need to analyze the thing that is this direct threat, and this good person shit is not going to get me there. Toss it. Mm-hmm. You know, like, and that is that shift in Riley's brain that starts to make her compromise everything about herself. And I think everybody can identify with these moments, like you said, with the bullying. Like, I'm not a bully, that's not my personality, but I like tested the waters there probably to see if I could connect to somebody and fit in with somebody, yeah. right? Yeah. But it's not the kind of person that you are. Nobody would say that about you, right? And but everyone makes those compromises, I think, at this time in your life while you're trying to just figure it the fuck out.
Yeah, you're overthinking. And I definitely had times in my life where that was my MO, was just anything that can go wrong will go wrong. So let me think about everything, that every detail of tomorrow, to make sure that I'm completely prepared. And it's okay prepared. To be prepared, you know, in general, when it comes to yeah. work and things like that. Or like, hey, what if this happens? Do we have a, it's, you're not putting ourselves in danger. But you get so overprepared that, yeah, it weighs on you. You're overthinking every single detail. But with that, I wanted to segue, like, what did you think of the overall, because obviously we saw this in theaters, we didn't have our notebooks, you can't, I have terrible penmanship in the dark, but I didn't take a lot of notes, but what did you think about the overall plot structure of what's happening inside her brain, of that journey to get back to the main hub, as well as outside with the hockey team developments?
I thought they worked in parallel very well, and I think the high level, like, the, I think the point of this is that the internal brain journey is more important, right, to us, but it has real world external effects. You know, it has an immediate impact on the things that Riley is actually doing in the world.
I liked that about this one, was that we actually saw more of what was happening outside. Granted, it's been 6 years since I've seen Inside Out, but I feel like in this, we actually see more of what Riley's experiencing, which was cool.
Yeah. And one of my favorite examples of that is the sarcasm. That is my favorite
sarcasm
on the internal journey, is like they come to sarcasm and they're on one side of the chasm and these workers are on the other side of the chasm and they're trying to talk to them in a perfectly normal and calm, polite, cool way. And it just comes out as sarcasm. And you feel this, it was just the most relatable thing I could possibly connect to in this film, I think, because you feel like you're trying to have a normal conversation with someone and it is just not connecting. There is a disconnect there. And my family will attest that, like, this was me. Everything I said that came out of my mouth was sarcastic. And you are genuinely not aware that you are being misinterpreted. You know what I mean? Like, you're playing with sarcasm at this point and you don't understand how it comes off. And I just thought it was the funniest scene of, like, them, like, man, those people are jerks. Man, those people are jerks. You know, like you're just, you're not able to connect with anybody because of these disconnects, I think, in your brain, in your own brain. But there was, you know, they're going through her brain, obviously, to get to the sense of self, which they think they need to restore so that she will be better now or back to normal Riley, which is what they keep saying. And they get locked in a vault. They break out of the vault. And there's this big, deep, dark secret in the vault that you don't, you know, you don't quite find out about it.
Also in the vault, though, is probably, we didn't mention during, because I guess this kind of would be a trailer, just because it's not in the trailer, so this would kind of be a spoiler, but Ron Funches as Bloofy the dog, I think he steals the show, honestly. Like, how kind of Bing Bong in the first one stole the show a little bit. Everyone thinks about Bing Bong. In this, Bloofy kills it. I think Bloofy's hilarious.
I think Bloofy is hilarious, and there's so many, it's funny that the things that are put in the vault, the things that she's ashamed of, you know, if you just look at the how they coalesce and all the different, you know, characters, and that they have to break out, and how they break out is pretty funny on the whole. But they feel like they need to break out to go, again, get her sense of self. But while they're doing that, anxiety is establishing a new sense of self that is completely rooted in these negative memories, these negative experiences, these fears, these aspects of self-doubt. And what's interesting to me about anxiety, and this is what I love, and actually this is like the therapy in me talking, is anxiety thinks she's helping you. Anxiety thinks she's protecting you.
Mm-hmm.
That's what's important to understand here. She is in service of Riley. She is trying to protect Riley. She thinks she's doing what's best for her. And it takes the course of this film for her to realize that she kind of fucked it up, you know?
But I think they do a good job, at least at when they bring it full circle at the end, to say, hey, a little anxiety, and we just talked about preparedness, like a little anxiety is a good thing.
It's
this is
normal,
a necessary emotion that you need to have. It's when you let it run your life
take
that
over.
It becomes a problem. Yeah,
totally. And I think it culminates in her freak out at the console, you know, where, and again, to the internal and external point that you made of like her internal, you see it happening at the console in such a really visually stunning way that again is makes so much sense, you know. And she's just a little fucking tornado at that console, pressing every button, trying to fix
it's
everything.
A great segue into Twisters next week.
100%. We have a tornado here, we have a tornado there. 100%. And then you see it manifest. She fucks up in the game. She like, you know, then she sits down and she realizes how bad it was, and she just goes into a full blown panic attack. But that's the thing that makes her realize, and I think it's an important step for her, makes her realize that she can't control Riley's sense of self. She can't do the right thing for Riley on her own.
Mm-hmm.
And Joy comes back at the same time. They make it back with her sense of self. She puts it back. But anxiety realizing that she can't control Riley is what helps Joy realize that she also can't control Riley.
And the entire bad memories in the back of the brain thing was a terrible decision. Yeah.
It was a terrible decision. And now it's permeated her mind anyway. So like you just, it was just a, you know, Band-Aid over a bullet hole, right? And so she lets it go, removes both senses of self, and lets a new one form. And I think that's such a great visual metaphor for puberty and how you come through it a different person, really.
Yeah. Now, the one thing that kind of bothered me about that, the aftermath of the panic attack and her Riley's realization of what's going on in the situation and kind of the mistakes she's made, I liked the moral there. I don't love that she still makes the team. I feel like they could have played out the ending a little differently. She doesn't apologize to the coach. She just goes out and passes a couple times. The coach is like, okay, you're on the team. Like, it just felt a little unearned.
I feel like, so I read this later because I couldn't remember. I couldn't remember that scene because, again, we saw it in theaters one time and it's been a month. And I was like, does she make the team? She just sees a piece of paper and her face lights up.
Yeah.
It's not necessarily that she made it.
Do you think the paper says you didn't make the team and she's...
No. I don't know that she's super happy. I think like, so I have a girlfriend, her daughter had a very similar situation with volleyball, for example. And she was obsessed with volleyball. She worked her ass off. She didn't make the team. Right. Yeah. And instead of being super fucking devastated about it, she was like, well, that's okay. I'm just going to hustle harder, you know, and I'm going to make it the next time. And she fucking did. And I think Riley has either way, this news is going to be okay, because she's either going to work really hard for it and figure it out, or she made the team and she's relieved and she was happy. I think it would be really unlikely after her behavior in that game that she would be seen as mature enough to make the team.
Yeah, like that's she the hit part. Her own teammate. And I meant to call this out earlier as a former hockey player. I love that hockey is such a focal point of this, and it was in the first one too. But yeah. I really liked that component. But she literally checks her own teammate to steal the puck in order to score.
So, I would maybe need to rewatch that exact scene just to be certain. Like I said, I researched this again, but it seems unlikely to me that she would have made it. Like, I don't think that coach would have changed their mind off that notebook note that they already had that she wasn't ready, when the next day she comes in and she checks her teammate and she then has a panic attack. I don't think she then makes the team for that reason. Right.
And they could have, you said this was a $200 million budget. They could have splurged another $300K to add a scene of her playing on the freshman team while the coach of the senior team or the varsity team is in the stands giving her a thumbs up. That would have explained it away of like, hey, she... This doesn't make everything right just because she had this grand realization. She did some messed up stuff, and she's going to have to earn it back. I think they could have just told that a little better.
Yeah, and I think that's fair, because I think it's easy to interpret that she made it, but I don't think that's realistic. It's probably that she made a team, but not that team, right? Like a JV versus varsity, right? Like, I doubt that she made the team after that behavior. But I don't – that was one of my notes, too, of this – learning experience for Riley is so truncated, and it implies that she's like all better now. And, you know, puberty does not move that quickly, and your emotions don't resolve themselves that quickly. And so it feeling a little bit like all happy ending-y, even though I know that's not exactly what they were trying to do. That was where, to me, it kind of lost me a little bit, where I was like, I don't feel like she would just be, you know, everything has come to a resolution, you know?
I think that's a fair take for sure. It's a momentary moment of happiness and, hey, I've kind of got things not completely sorted out, but I feel comfortable right now. That's not to say that things aren't going to get rough again at some point, you know?
Yeah.
I think emotions are a wave that you ride. And even as somebody who's gone through depression, you come out of that and you feel really good about surviving and being good about it. That doesn't mean that I don't occasionally get sad again, but you have that moment, and maybe it's just we see her in this moment of the happy ending, knowing that it's still going to be complicated from there on.
Oh, for sure. But I agree with you. I think they could have thrown in like a little scene to give some context to that, to make it feel a little bit more realistic of like, it's not a perfect ending, but it's, you know, it's progress. Yeah. She's making progress.
Facts.
Awesome. Well, I think overall, like we said, this was, you know, 7.5 out of 10 for me. I think 8 for you.
Did you stay after the credits?
I think I did.
Did you see the reveal of the deep, dark secret?
Yes. Yes, I did. Yeah. She burned a hole in the rug.
I mean, it's funny.
I wanted it to be a little bigger. I'm not saying she should have committed a murder, but I did want it to be like a little bit better of a reveal. Yeah.
I thought they were going full sociopath. Like, remember that time we crushed a frog with a hammer just to see what taking life felt like? And it's like, holy shit, this guy. And then I remember it was a kid's movie. This is not Deadpool and Wolverine.
It's actually not for you, Lamar. I'm sorry to tell you. But yeah, I agree. I feel like it could have been a little bit more interesting reveal. I don't know. Maybe like she kissed a boy. You know what I mean? Like that would be more in line with her age and also feel like a secret or, you know, whatever. I don't know. Yeah. It was weird. But like we said, guys, worth a watch. Very funny. Holds up to the first one very well. Like we said, I think it's still a very good film.
It does it justice. And I think the best part of this is, again, the expansion on the concept, because I think the first one's pretty straightforward. Yeah. If here's four emotions you feel, here's what's going on in your head when they happen. This one, with the addition of things like the sarcasm and the self-belief and all these, it's just as you grow up, these emotions get more complex. I dug that.
Yeah, they appear. Oh, and I forgot. I wore orange for anxiety.
I guess I wore red for anger. I didn't get the memo.
That checks out. That checks out. All right. Well, thanks for joining, fam. As we alluded to earlier, come back next week for our final blockbuster of 2024's summer, Twisters.
Which, if you're one of those people who says I only tune in for the episodes that I've seen the movie, go see this movie while it's in theaters. Yeah. I had my doubts. if I had seen it on a small screen streaming, I don't think I would have enjoyed it as much, but it is a fucking spectacle.
It is a spectacle. Exactly. That's the best way to say it. Even if you, you know, are not a Twisters fan, like, it's an action movie. It's like best viewed in a theater. So yes, absolutely go see it. So in the meantime, though.
Yeah. Follow us on our socials. We drink and we watch things. Pretty active on Instagram and now active on TikTok. So give us a follow, like, comment. I think we actually did ask for some feedback last week when we covered Deadpool and Wolverine, a favorite X-Men, in the comments. Yeah. So give us some engagement there. We're trying to grow our audience. That definitely helps us out. Feel free to email us at We Drink and We Watch Things Pod if you're old school. And here is a super early teaser, because we are about 2 months away from our 1 year anniversary, Mackenzie.
Can you believe it?
I can believe it. It's a lot of work doing a podcast.
Yeah, actually, we can believe it. You're right. You're right. We can believe that this has been a fucking year of this. Yeah.
So keep, tune into our socials, because we're going to be asking for some audience feedback, engagement, maybe some call-ins of some type. Well, it's a little teaser there for you. So make sure you're following us in preparation for the 1 year episode.
Yeah, 100%. Good call. All right. Well, for now, go have a drink and watch a thing. Cheers.
Cheers.
Clink, clink. I feel like my clink, clink effect is pretty strong.
It's pretty solid. It's very solid. Yes.